Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday, March 28th, 2022 meeting of the Minnesota House Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings such as this are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their packets available to them, and for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Mr. Lee, will you please now take an oral roll call of members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roll call will now commence. Chair Davney?
Present.
Representative Sandstead will be joining us later. Representative Kreisha?
Present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Daniels?
Present.
Representative Damith?
Present.
Representative Dravkowski? Representative Dravkowski? Representative Erickson?
Erickson, present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, present.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller, present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Thompson? Representative Thompson? Representative Walgamott?
Walgamott, present.
Representative Schoen?
Present.
Representative Joachim?
Present.
Mr. Chair, report, we have quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. Representative Marquardt, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from our Thursday, March 24th meeting? And if so, would you like to move approval of those same minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the March 24th, 2022 minutes of the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, any discussion to the Marquardt motion? Seeing none, this is a voice vote. If you'd please unmute. All those in favor of the Marquardt motion approving the March 24th, 2022 minutes of this committee, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Members, our first bill hearing we have for today is House File 1729 from Representative Jordan. It's our intention to lay this bill over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill by 11 a.m. Representative Jordan, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1729 before the committee and to lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and members of the committee. I'm pleased to present House File 1729, the Hunger-Free Schools Act. This bill would provide every student in Minnesota with breakfast and lunch at school. This bill requires eligible schools to participate in the Federal Community Eligibility Provision, or CEP. Some people also call it SEP. CEP is a federal program that provides universal, no-cost meals at schools in high-poverty neighborhoods where many students come from families eligible for SNAP and other nutrition assistance. Students and their families do not need to apply as they do with free and reduced price lunch programs. Minnesota is currently the eighth worst in the nation for schools enrolled in CEP. This bill is an opportunity for everyone, Democrats, Republicans, and independents across the state to come together to feed children. Universal meals in total will cost $187.419 million in fiscal year 23. This accounts for approximately $18 million in school breakfast, $168.831 million for school lunch, and an additional $788K for MDE administration. This is on top of current base funding for those programs. The proposal will go up in fiscal year 24 to $194.826 million and $202.607 million in fiscal year 25. This increases account for the assumption of an annual 4% bump in participation. The program with CEP actually brings the cost of universal meals down by roughly $600K by leveraging increased participation in the federal program, which would generate more federal funds. I have many incredible testifiers that can provide better context for why this bill is so necessary right now, but before they speak, I want members to remember that we know programs to tackle childhood hunger in our schools work because they are already working. During the pandemic, our federal government recognized the critical link between schools and healthy families, and they and our school districts broke down barriers to set up food pickup sites. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to testimony.
Thank you very much, Representative Jordan. Members, we have a technological experience here. One of the upsides of meeting virtually is it expands ways that the public can interact and participate in the legislative process. So we are going to start with Eric, Amber, Deborah, and Will via video testimonials. So if staff could facilitate that, please.
Over the last couple years, I'd say we've had pretty challenging times for our family, especially because of the global pandemic. But just before that, we actually lost our mom, so I had to step up and become the legal guardian for my siblings. I know I'm not able to always provide them with the healthiest, most nutritious meals before or after school. So I'm pretty grateful that the inclusion of the free school meals for all campaign is being involved in these budget discussions, knowing that they'll get all the access and stuff at school is really nice to see.
And we make just above the threshold to get free stuff, okay, to get free lunches, reduced lunches, you know, SNAP, any of that stuff. But I mean, we're barely above the threshold, so we're still like working poor. I mean, I still rely on like food shelves and things like that to supplement, and I don't know where the money was supposed to come from. I'd go and I'd talk to him and I thought I had it strained out, I'll pay it on my next payday, whatever. So when the governor did the thing last year with the pandemic EBT, oh my God, we had food. The kids could get food from school and we had food. I was just, it was a godsend. It was such a blessing.
What we have at Cass Lake is called the Community Eligibility Provision, otherwise known as CEP. This program is so important to our students, but it's even more important to our community because our parents don't have to come up with the funds for the meals that the students are having. And it is just an essential component to our meal service. I don't know how I would operate without our CEP program.
And I didn't really have any money in my account, and I just got some money. I put all my money into my lunch so I could eat because my parents aren't really all that financially stable right now in order to pay for my school lunch. Because when I'm in class, my lunch isn't until like 1 or something, and I'll be in my class and I'll just be sitting there like, oh my gosh, when is lunch gonna come? Because like, I'm so hungry, I haven't ate all day. It kind of sucks because by the time I get home, I'm really hungry. And man, what would it be like if we could all just eat for free? If we all have free food, I feel like that would impact us in a good way.
Thank you to those testifiers, and thank you for facilitating the video there. Next on my list is Bukata Hayes, Vice President of Racial and Health Equity with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Dabney and members of the committee, my name is Bukata Hayes. I'm the Vice President for Racial and Health Equity at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm pleased to join you today to underscore the importance of providing universal meals in Minnesota schools and stress the urgency of addressing food insecurity at our state. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota is the state's largest health plan, proudly serving approximately 2.6 million members. We have a long history of working to address public health issues in our state, and in 2020, we declared racism a public health crisis. This proposal is in strong alignment with that commitment and would make a significant impact on addressing racial and health inequities in our state. We know that young people need consistent fuel, proper nutrition to thrive in school. But today, one in six Minnesota children is food insecure, an unacceptably high rate of hunger. School meals are a critical source for nutrition for many children, helping them learn and be active in the short term, and then thrive academically, physically, and emotionally in the long term. This is an issue that's deeply personal to me. I am the product. I benefited from investments like this and those who needed it. My mom was a single parent who raised four young men all by herself in the inner city. And so one of the certainties that we had in our day was the food that we would get while we were in school because we were free and reduced lunch. Those meals allowed us to excel in both in-classroom and co-curricular activities. And so I think it's just critical that we provide that certainty and that foundation for school-aged children within our communities in our state. And with the temporary federal aid allowing school meals set to expire at the end of the school year, we urge you to support the bill so that we continue to ensure all children receive the nourishment they need to be successful in school, and that bill being HF 1729. I thank you for your leadership in addressing this critical issue of childhood hunger and food insecurity in our state, and for the opportunity to share my testimony with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Next up, Stacy Coppin, Director of Nutrition for the St. Paul Public Schools. Ms. Coppin, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Stacy Coppin. Chairman Dabney and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Stacy Coppin. I am a registered dietitian, and I've spent a large part of my career working in school meals. Prior to that, I was also a student who qualified for free lunch. Having seen both the advantages and the pitfalls of the pre-pandemic meal programs that we are set to return to in June, I offer my personal perspective here that universal meal programs can be improved. Statistics tell us one in four food insecure children in Minnesota are from households that are not eligible for free school meals. That's people like Amber, who we saw in the video, that face a struggle that neither parents nor children should have to learn about in our public schools. The struggle is hunger. I've personally encountered many parents who earn only a few dollars more than the household income gap to qualify for free meals. Those parents are forced to dilute their food resources to ensure their children have something to eat during the school day. When parents ask me, how can this possibly be right? What on earth am I supposed to do? All I can offer as a school nutrition operator is an apology and suggest that hopefully fundraisers will bring enough money to help by the end of the year. Then, as required by USDA, I'm obligated to send these parents a copy of an unpaid meal charge policy. I'm also required to send low balance reminders to those families, and I literally work, wait, and see how it will work out at the end of the year. Good nutrition is just as critical as textbooks and transportation, which we do not charge against families. When children are hungry, we know they cannot learn. I can also tell you that as children grow older, the stigma of participating in free meal programs competes with our internal drive to meet one of our most basic human requirements, and that's the physiological need for food. Even students who qualify for free meals are prone to go hungry because of shame. Our free lunch programs, as they are today and are set to return to in June, do not work. At best, districts are held responsible for covering a financial gap that exists after state and federal funding. This is harmful to our extremely underfunded educational system. At worst, for districts that don't participate in programs like CEP, parents are held solely responsible to the point that their children's health and academic success are at great risk. I have both confidence and hope that there is a better way to ensure that our children do not go hungry. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Coppin. Next, Aliyah Demery, Appetite for Change Youth Leader. Aliyah, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Good to have you here this morning.
Hi, my name is Aliyah Demery. I am a youth leader at Appetite for Change. I've been there for about 5 years now. I'm currently a student at St. Cloud State University. and I'm here to share my testimony. So I grew up in a single parent household throughout my whole K through 12. Unfortunately, my mother, she did not qualify for free reduced lunch. So which meant we basically had to figure it out. We first started off, my mom would make lunches for me and my younger siblings. But as I entered high school, she started working longer hours and things changed within then. She didn't really have much time to do that. For most students, you would think walking into school that you would have to worry about a test or making sure that you finished your assignment. For me, most of the time on my mind, I really worried about what was I going to eat for lunch. Would I like it as well? I knew that I didn't want to create another bill for my mom. Luckily, in my high school, we did have a school pantry, which I know most high schools don't. And most of the time, we really had to rely on if there would even be donations in that pantry as well. So that I could basically eat. I know for my younger siblings, I don't really want that to be a main thing on their mind. I just want them to be focused solely on school and getting their education done. I do know food and the right nutrition that you do bring into your body is a main key source to focusing. And as now that I have my leadership role within Appetite for Change and I am mentoring younger youth, I do see that food does make it big impact on how students perform in school and outside of school as well. I think that having this bill passed and conversations as such is very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Demery. Last of the author's testifiers, Dr. Gigi Chawla, Children's Minnesota Chief of General Pediatrics. Dr. Chawla, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Dr. Gigi Chawla, Chief of General Pediatrics at Children's Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today to express Children's Minnesota's support for House File 1729. As the largest pediatric health system in the state, serving over 135,000 kids annually, Children's Minnesota serves an incredibly diverse patient population from every county, with almost half of our patients enrolled in Medicaid. I'm here today because proper nutrition is fundamental to every aspect of a child's health and well-being. Studies show that children who experience hunger are more likely to struggle in school. For younger kids, hunger can look like kids who are dysregulated or who aren't focused, but rather distracted and fatigued. Simply put, growing brains need calories to develop. Chronic undernourishment of growing, developing brains may evolve into developmental delays, which both the education and healthcare sectors put resources into supporting and correcting. The intervention at the onset could have been quality food. Feeding kids a nutritious breakfast and lunch is one way to get it right from the start. Yet another example of getting it right from the start is equity. Children's Minnesota is a member of the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity, who also submitted a letter in support of this bill. We know the unique and varied challenges children in our state face. Children of color, and more specifically, Black and Latino children, are disproportionately impacted by food insecurity. Kids who are food insecure are more likely to consume lower quality, higher processed foods that are more likely to cause weight gain. When what kids eat when they are young sets up a trajectory of eating that is really hard to break. Overweight kids are more likely to be overweight adults. Something as simple as providing a highly nutritious, balanced breakfast and lunch at school can address these disparities in a very real, significant way. In summary, we need to ensure that students can continue accessing the nutritious food they need so their growing brains can focus on learning, not hunger. By providing no-cost school meals, you are investing in the health of all kids and setting them up to achieve their highest developmental potential. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chawla. Members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. We received two requests for public testimony. First, Darcy Stuber, on behalf of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. Ms. Stuber, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman and members, I'm Darcy Stieber, Director of Nutrition Services for the Mankato Area Public Schools. I also serve as Public Policy Chair for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, and I am here to offer MSNA's support for a universal lunch and breakfast program found in House File 1729. Over the past 2 years, nutrition service departments across Minnesota opened their doors to feed hungry children throughout the pandemic. These nutrition heroes stepped up to the challenge and did so with pride. Universal meals will allow us to continue to serve all students. Families that do not qualify for free and reduced meals are not wealthy. They are middle-class families selling greeting cards and softener salt to help fundraise for their kids' extracurricular activities. By making meals available to all students, families do not have to make the choice to if they can afford to purchase school meals. Currently, students do not worry about Chromebooks, iPads, transportation. Why would we not provide the basic human need as a meal for our students? Eating at school leads to improved academic performance and fewer behavioral instances. When students are well-nourished, they are able to focus on their schoolwork. Students that regularly eat school meals receive better nutrition than students who bring their lunch from home. School meals are well-rounded by providing lean proteins, whole grains, a variety of fruits and vegetables, and reduced fat milk. Universal meals would greatly reduce and or eliminate the amount of debt in the school district food service accounts. When these balances go unpaid, the payment comes from the general fund, and that takes away from teaching and learning. After serving students free breakfast and lunch for the past 2 years, it is time that Minnesota steps forward as a leader in our nation and continues to serve free meals for all students. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Stuber. Also signed up for this portion of the hearing, Adosh Uni, Government Relations, the Minnesota Department of Education. Mr. Uni, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Adosh Uni. I am the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in HF 1729 to provide funding for universal meals and mandatory CEP participation. This session, we've heard about measures to provide caring and qualified teacher for students, support for special education, investing in English learner needs, providing multi-pronged approaches for mental health, among many other topics. All of these proposals are components to supporting the whole child. And making sure that all students are fed in schools is also a fundamental component to supporting the whole child and ensuring their academic, behavioral, and social emotional success. School meals are important for student health and well-being and provide students the nutrition they need throughout the day to learn. Kids who receive school meals are more likely to eat fruits, vegetables, and milk. These nutrient-dense foods contribute to a healthier body mass index and lower childhood obesity. These health benefits are particularly pronounced among low-income students. Research shows a well-nourished child is a better learner, test taker, and participant in school. Simply put, when kids have a full tummy, they are going to be able to pay attention much better. This forecasted appropriation would provide reimbursement to districts and schools equivalent to the difference between free lunch category rate for all students, which ranges from 366 to 368 per lunch and 197 to 235 for breakfast for fiscal 23, less any federal reimbursements received. And as Representative Jordan mentioned, the universal meals proposal in total will cost about $187.419 million in fiscal 23. This is on top of current base funding for those programs. And then the proposal increases for an assumption of an annual 4% bump in participation. And the federal CEP program further enhances this proposal by allowing high poverty schools and districts to serve breakfast and lunch at no cost to all enrolled students without collecting the household application. And again, as Representative Jordan mentioned, the CEP provision brings the universal meals cost down by roughly $600,000 by leveraging increased participation in the federal program, generating more federal funds. And I'll just take this opportunity to note the governor's revised budget includes $450,000 in additional administrative support for MDE to increase participation in the CEP program for increasing CEP participation for those that do not come under the IESP threshold. And this will increase outreach efforts, interagency coordination efforts, data analysis. And finally, I'll just say we support another provision in the bill for funding for school breakfast for students qualifying for early childhood special education services who are in a VPK-funded classroom. This proposal costs around $772,000 per year and this will eliminate an inadvertent disparity in the program when it was originally drafted. Again, thank you for the opportunity to provide supportive testimony for HF 1729 and the much needed nutrition support our students need.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Before we turn to member questions, I'd like to point out that Representative Sandsteed and Representative Thompson have joined the meeting. Member questions. Representative Erickson, you've been patient. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are for the author. And for all of us to remember that these meals aren't really free. We taxpayers are paying for all of them. And most everyone is a taxpayer of some sort. So these aren't free. But Representative Jordan, why not have a part of the bill say there's an opt-out for parents who can afford this or would prefer to serve breakfast before their children go to school so they can eat as a family?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Parents always have the option to serve their students and their children breakfast before, and students will still be allowed to bring their own lunch with them. They're not compelled to eat the school lunch that is being served.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan. But, you know, what we have seen is when a government program starts to take over in a school building, I've watched it, the kids sleep later and, you know, maybe they need more sleep at the high school level, I noticed. And they ignore that ability to have family time and parents give into it. And I'm not saying that is, you know, acceptable, but I think we're setting a standard here for all to have free breakfast and lunch that, for one, we'll run out of money sometime. And for another, we're going to be harming the family structure because we're enablers. And I want us to think carefully about that as we proceed. Another is we heard testimony about those, you know, who are right on the edge. But if we considered raising the poverty level, we could probably provide for those families that are right on that line that divides them from qualifying or not. So, you know, these are some considerations that we should think about if this proposal proceeds. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any other member questions? Representative Krisha, I see your hand up, but I wanted to pause for other members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can wait.
Representative Youakim.
I just wanted to thank Representative Jordan for being persistent and insistent around this issue for quite a few years. When I was at policy chair, we were discussing this as well. I don't think there's a real lot of argument that people have that children learn better when they're fed and they have the nutrition in their bellies, and we heard that in some of the testimony. It just seems like a basic sense of decency to feed the kids that come in our doors. And personally, I wasn't making the connection with the family unit thing. I'm sorry, Representative Erickson, maybe you and I can chat offline about that. But kids still would have the opportunity to not partake in the school lunch. It seems that if they're under our roofs in our public schools, we should be taking care of them and taking care of their needs so that they can get down to the real business of being educated. So thank you so much for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Youakim. Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the bill author. Certainly there's lots of laudable and great ideas that we could be looking at doing. I'm more concerned about how you would actually propose this happening. Two questions I have for you. How are you going to measure the results and what would be those metrics of success? And then the second question is, given the immense shortage of labor and people we have right now, how will this impact that, and will schools be able to actually find the people to serve this program?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Uni from MDE would be best positioned to talk about how MDE will measure the success of this program. And then perhaps one of our directors of nutrition could talk about staffing.
Mr. Uni, can you be of assistance here?
Mr. Chair, committee members, and Representative Krisha, to your question, as I had testified, we know that children who are better fed have a wide range of outcomes. I'd be happy to go back to the team and provide research for the committee. I just don't have that on hand. In terms of measurement of the state-funded as well as federal-funded programs, I'm not sure if there are any requirements that look at that have the department, whether it be state or federal, be required to analyze any type of impacts for the actual allocation of funds when we increased the funds back, I think in 2013 or 14, I think that was the same case back then. But I am happy to come back to the committee and provide some research that tie increased funding for students in nutrition with outcomes academically, behaviorally, and social emotional.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Do either of the school nutrition directors on the call have insights on staff levels? We know that workforce has been a challenge in schools this year.
Sure, I could speak on behalf of that.
Ms. Stuber, thank you very much.
So it has been a challenge staffing at all levels for nutrition programs throughout Minnesota. We currently are running a paid program through the government currently, students are getting meals at no charge, paid through the current pandemic waivers that we've been receiving the last 2 years. So we are currently running the program that we are discussing today, and we would just are asking for a continuation, basically, to continue to feed our students at no charge. So the work is already being done.
Thank you, Ms. Stuber. Representative Krisha, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need some more. I think it would be helpful to have some more concrete answers. Mr. Uni, as you look at the data, I think one of the things that we need to make sure, if we're going to put metrics in place, is that those outcomes just aren't basically meals served, because I don't think you can say there's a causation between the number of meals served and the outcomes that will be. Certainly, we have lots of anecdotal about when we have our basic needs met as far as hunger, but there's also sleep, there's rest time, there's less stress. I mean, we have lots of things that we can try to ascribe to outcomes, but the reality is it's a complicated world out there, and we need to find some specifics, as well as let students deal with some of the resiliency that's out there. So I hope that one of those outcomes wouldn't just be the number of meals served, because that becomes a perpetuation of more government programs that really doesn't ascribe to outcomes. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Krisha. Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank all the advocates who have helped me shape this bill and talk about the different, how we can actually end childhood hunger. I think some of the best testimony is the fact that this committee is right before lunch. And I often find myself thinking about lunch instead of focusing on committee. And I think about what it was like to be a student and a child trying to concentrate on math right before lunch, and what a difficult endeavor that was. So I want to also just mention that we know that these programs work because they're already working. We have managed to feed children universally through the pandemic, and the family unit has not collapsed. I think there are ways for us to teach resiliency, but forcing children to go hungry is not a measure of grit, and it is not something that should be done to children. And if we have the tools and have proven that we can already do this, we should do this. So to close, members, this is a bill to really close the opportunity gaps between white students and student color. This is a bill to improve student mental health, and this is a bill to grow happy and healthy families across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. With that, Representative Jordan renews her motion to lay over House File 1729 for possible inclusion or further consideration at a later date. Our next bill hearing will be hearing House File 3264 from Representative Howard. It's our intention to take action on this bill by 11:15 a.m. Representative Wolgamott, would you like to make a motion to move House File 3265 before the committee and to refer it to Health, Finance, and Policy?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Representative Howard, welcome back to the committee. Before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment you'd like to offer to get the bill into the shape you'd prefer. The chair moves the A3 amendment to be before the committee to put the bill in the shape that the author prefers. Representative Howard, can you please speak to the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The AE3 amendment includes a few changes as we worked with the bill with school districts to ensure that we have assured funding source for our school districts to complete lead mitigation. It also includes some language around transparency for parental notification, as well as language regarding municipal water sources to ensure that schools wouldn't be held liable to perform mitigation if the problem occurs outside of their outside of the building.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Members, any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, again, members, this will be a voice vote. If you'd please unmute. All those in favor of the motion to approve the A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Howard, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I think we can all agree that the water our students drink at school should be safe and free of lead. After all, by the time most kids graduate from high school, they will have spent more than 15,000 hours at school. Since the crisis in Flint, Michigan, we have seen a greater recognition of the dangers of lead in our water. States all across the country are taking steps to mitigate and address what is a pervasive problem for buildings that were built prior to the 80s. But the reality is, with the availability of newer health data and considering what other states are doing, here in Minnesota, we can do better. And so what this bill seeks to do is take the steps necessary to ensure we're getting lead out of drinking water in every school in our state. It's a realistic and achievable goal, but only if we work together to take this problem more seriously. In way of background, currently Minnesota schools are testing for lead and working in partnership with MDH and MDA on mitigation strategies. That said, we don't really have a complete picture of this challenge because there's not any centralized reporting. In addition, schools that have been testing and mitigating when levels of lead are above 15 parts per billion or higher, that is not truly a health-based standard as there's no safe level for lead. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we can improve on that in this bill. The other challenge is that mitigating lead is costly for schools to both conduct the testing and to do remediation if they need to. It is not often as costly as a lead service line replacement, as we've heard about, but things like fixtures and plumbing fittings that need to be replaced, that all can add up. In particular, it can be a challenge for our smaller rural districts or our larger districts that have many, many buildings. And so this bill attempts to address these gaps in our current system in a number of ways. First, we include some centralized reporting so that we as policymakers and the public can get a better handle on the state of this issue. A national survey found that 37% of districts tested for lead came back with elevated levels. How does that track here in Minnesota? The reality is we don't know. We need to do more testing or a more centralized testing and data collection to get to understand the scope of the challenge. Second, we're moving the threshold for remediation from 15 parts per billion to 5 parts per billion. Again, there's no safe level for lead, but newer research found harm from consumer water with levels above 5 parts per billion. And of note, the 5 parts per billion is the max amount of lead contamination that the U.S. FDA allows for bottled water. So this is a direction that we should move towards and a standard we should move towards. As it relates to funding, we believe that if we're going to ask districts to mitigate for lead, that given the myriad of challenges they face, we ought to provide some funding sources. Currently, federal grants are available for the first time, but we think we need to do more. With this amendment, the bill includes a funding stream that is recognizable and usable for districts. The bill also includes some grants through MDH, which is part of the governor's supplemental budget. Just a couple other points before we turn it to testifiers. There's a lot of already existing communication and partnership that's happening between our school districts, MDH and MDE, to test, mitigate, and keep our schools safe. And they're doing very good work. But with additional resources, better data collection, we can build on that great work for the benefit of cleaner drinking water and healthier kids. In closing, I want to thank members of the committee that were on education policy who supported this bill when it passed unanimously a few weeks ago. With this amendment, it is even a stronger bill that moves us in the direction towards an ultimate goal I hope we all share, which is getting lead out of school drinking water. And with that, I turn it to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howard. First on the list of testifiers is Molly Cotting, researcher. Ms. Cotting, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm grateful to be here today testifying again in support of this bill. My name is Molly Cotting, and I'm a researcher. I helped pass similar legislation in Washington State last year. I'm going to tailor my time with you today to talk about why this measure is important and how Minnesota will benefit from investing in reducing lead in our school drinking water. Chronic lead exposure can cause serious cognitive, behavioral, and emotional deficits in children that follow them into adulthood. At just 15 parts per billion in the blood, children can lose up to 3.2 IQ points. Lead would also hurt their working memory, perceptual reasoning, and their behavior in the classroom. This affects their ability to learn, to graduate, and maximize their potential. This bill seeks to protect students from this real threat, and I urge you to support lowering our lead action level to 5 parts per billion to reduce their risk of elevated blood lead levels. Lead exposure from school drinking water is a significant exposure pathway. Allocating funding to reduce student exposure is a smart investment for our state. A 2009 Economic Policy Institute study found that for every dollar spent on lead hazard reduction, $17 to $20 could be saved on healthcare costs, lifetime earning potential, taxable revenue, special education resources, and more. New federal grant applications, as well as allocating state funding, will help schools across the state access the support they need to help reduce students' overall lead burden. We're doing the right thing when we reduce and eliminate lead exposure for our students, especially those at higher risk of exposure. This bill builds upon our state's strong testing requirement. It takes seriously our responsibility to ensure environmental health equity in our state and demonstrates our strong support for public schools. I urge you to vote yes and send a strong bill through. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Cotting. Next, Steve Ring with the Sierra Club North Star Chapter, Water and Wetlands Stewards Program. Mr. Ring, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am Steve Ring, and I'm a volunteer on behalf of the Sierra Club North Star Chapter. I chair their Waters and Wetlands Stewards Committee. I also worked for more than 30 years at the Minnesota Department of Health, much of that time doing lab analyses of toxins and pollutants. I speak in support of House File 3265. I want to thank you, the legislature, for passing the School Lead Protection Bill in 2018. That was a big step forward, and it is the foundation for this bill. A major provision of this bill is a tighter, more definitive standard for lead exposure. Regarding lead exposure and impacts, it is now clear the more we learn about it, the lower the standard must be. According to the World Health Organization, even low levels of lead in children may be associated with decreased intelligence, behavioral difficulties, and learning problems. There is no known therapy for lead in the blood. There is no known therapy for lead in the blood. Therefore, prevention of exposure is crucial. Virtually every agency, academy, and nation that advises on or regulates lead concentrations in drinking water has reduced its earlier recommended control levels. Many now advocate for the 5 parts per billion standard that this bill requires. The FDA, as Representative Howard mentioned, the FDA requires bottled water to meet the 5 parts per billion standard. And note, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends, quote, state and local government should take steps to ensure that water fountains in schools do not exceed water lead concentrations of 1 part per billion. The Environmental Protection Agency's maximum contaminant level goal for lead is 0. This is the level determined to be safe according to toxicological and biomedical considerations, independent of feasibility. The 2018 Minnesota law required public reporting of lead testing results, but there was no standard format for reporting the data and no central repository to store the information. The inclusion of these provisions in this bill will have a huge benefit for protecting Minnesota kids. Elevated lead concentrations have been associated with low-income communities, both urban and rural. Reliable data will allow us to track trends and identify problems that might otherwise be missed. We understand that any added requirements for school facilities can be a burden to school districts. We appreciate the financial provisions of this bill that will help address that issue as we protect our children from lead exposure in their schools. Thank you for your time, and I ask that you support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Ring. Last on the list of testifiers is Dr. Shelby Graff, pediatrician. Dr. Graff, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is Shelby Graff, and I am a pediatrician in Minneapolis. I work inpatient at Masonic Children's Hospital and at the outpatient peds clinic at Hennepin County Medical Center. I get to provide both preventative care as well as caring for kids when they're admitted to the hospital. Lead is a toxic metal, and in young children, lead toxicity is usually due to ingestion from lead paint or toys or contaminated drinking water. The effects of lead toxicity are devastating on the developing brain. As soon as a child starts showing symptoms, we consider it an emergency. Students with elevated lead levels struggle with developmental delays, higher dropout rates, reading disabilities, and aggression. Other effects include kidney damage, seizures, and growth delay. Lasting cognitive impairment is seen in children with lead levels as low as 5 micrograms per deciliter. Chelation therapy with a chemical called dimercaptosuccinic acid, or DMSA, helps prevent further damage, but it can't reverse effects that have already occurred. There's no actual treatment for lead poisoning. In Minnesota, we check the level of lead in about 90,000 children per year. We screen kids at ages 1 and 2 by checking the lead level in their blood, but I've personally seen lead toxicity in children through adolescence. Working at HCMC allows me the opportunity to care for some of the more vulnerable populations in our community. In this country, Black children with lead levels meeting the treatment threshold is 2 times higher than the percentage of white children. That percentage is 4 times higher in kids living in a higher poverty bracket compared to those in a lower poverty bracket. The only way to prevent lead toxicity is to provide children an environment in which they're protected from lead exposure. When a child comes to my clinic with elevated lead, we recommend the family uproot their lives to find new housing. Individual families should not be solely responsible for reducing exposure, especially when the toxic effects are cumulative from every source of lead these children are exposed to. This bill would provide several measures to significantly reduce the risk of lead toxicity for my patients, and so I advocate that you vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Graff. Members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this hearing. We received no request from the public for testimony. Member questions? Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. So I'm just curious. I appreciate the bill. Thank you for bringing it up. How big is this problem? Specifically, what do we know and which schools are experiencing this?
I'm going to go to the author for that one, although he may phone a friend, so the testifiers should be wary. Representative Howard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Krisha. The most clear way I can answer your question is we don't know, which is part of the reason we need to pass this bill, that we don't have a great sense of the cumulative or collective challenge because we don't have a central repository for to collect some of the data of what's going. We do have anecdotal reports, and perhaps somebody from MDH, that's why I would phone a friend to talk a little bit about kind of the state of play as it sits now. But I reiterate the statistic that nationally, where they've done some of this analysis, 30, 40% of schools came back with elevated lead levels. And so there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this is probably pretty pervasive for schools that were built prior to the 80s. And so that makes it a pretty challenging statewide issue.
Is there a representative from MDH who would like to speak to Representative Krisha's question?
Hi, this is Anna Schleep at the Minnesota Department of Health. I work
with lead in drinking water in schools and water systems.
Thank you, Ms. Schley. Please, thank you for joining us today. Please proceed.
Yep. So there are, we've had the requirement for schools to do testing since and start that testing since 2018. As the representative mentioned, we don't have a central repository for that data. So if an individual wants to know about a particular school's data, they have to contact that school or district directly. So most schools that are larger publish their data on their individual websites, and smaller schools might provide it by request. So we don't have a large repository of data on schools that are doing testing. So that's one reason why this bill would be helpful in gathering that large data on the state of school of lead in drinking water in schools throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Schley. Representative Kreisha, follow up?
Yeah. Yes, please. Thank you. So to the bill author, and again, so it sounds like we're getting our arms around the data that may or may not exist isn't there. I find that interesting because it sounds like we have a health community that knows when people are coming in and they actually declare an emergency. So if there was a widespread problem, I would imagine we'd have crosstab information coming through the health communities. It's interesting that, and thank you for the person from MDE talking about that we really don't know. All this leads me to wonder, I know that in my town in Little Falls, and I suspect other areas, I can simply just have the city come out and test my water and give me a reading of where the levels are at. Is that not possible for other schools around the state?
Ms. Schleep, can you help with that? I'm going to ask you to step back in as possibly the best source.
Yeah, so every city is different on how they test following a customer request for testing. Some places will provide an individual customer with a list of certified laboratories so they can do their own testing. Some places will do testing for you. If Little Falls does it, I know St. Paul will provide lead testing for drinking water. In terms of schools, because school buildings are so different in terms of water usage, the source of lead that we're looking at in schools is primarily from the internal plumbing rather than the lead service line that leads from the building to the water main. So the testing is done, it's different in a school building or that type of larger building than it would be done in a home building. So schools are also have tens to hundreds of different individual fountains and sinks and faucets that might be used for cooking and drinking. So schools tend to do their own testing rather than a water system doing, say, one sample at a school, because every one of those individual faucets may have a different level based on the plumbing materials leading up to it.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the bill author, so again, appreciate the idea. I think that understanding our lead levels is very, very important. It sounds like we're not there yet. I would just offer up, as somebody who spent many years wiring and crawling through tunnels and networks of schools, all those diagrams of the school's plumbing is readily available. And so I would think there are ways that we could get our schools to start to get some preliminary testing data to actually get our arms around how big this problem is. Rather than trying a all-out approach of just guessing that it's a big problem based on some national standards that are out there. So I appreciate the bill. I hope that we can get more detailed and actually get more surgical about how we could solve a problem or find a problem if it actually exists and then go after it. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. With that, Representative Howard, opportunity both to respond and any concluding comments before we vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in way of a quick response, I would say, I think we do know this is a problem. The schools are doing this work and testing and are finding elevated lead levels, and they're having to mitigate and wrestle with that with their budgets. And when an issue is as serious as lead poisoning for our children, it's not appropriate for us to just wait and see on this. We can and should take action. And this is a really common sense way to do this work in partnership with our schools. And like I said, this has had bipartisan support in the past, and I hope it will going forward. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howard. With that, Representative Wolgamott renews his motion to refer House File 3265 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Mr. Lee, would you please call the roll?
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Roll call voting for HF 3265 will now commence. Chair Dabney?
Dabney votes aye.
Chair Dabney, aye. Representative Sandstead?
Aye.
Representative Sandstead, aye. Representative Kreisha?
Aye.
Representative Kreisha, aye. Representative Bennett?
Aye.
Representative Bennett, aye. Representative Daniels?
Daniels votes aye.
Representative Daniels, aye. Representative Damith?
Aye.
Representative Damith, aye. Representative Dravkowski?
No.
Representative Dravkowski, no. Representative Erickson?
Erickson, aye.
Representative Erickson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Representative Jordan, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Representative Marquardt, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Richardson, aye. Representative Thompson?
Thompson votes aye.
Representative Thompson, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott votes aye.
Representative Wolgamott, aye. Representative Shung?
Aye.
Representative Shung, aye. Representative Joachim?
Joachim, aye.
Representative Joachim, aye. Mr. Chair, I report we have 16 ayes and one no.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. With a vote of 16 to 1, the motion prevails in House File 3265 and Representative Howard are both off to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair, good luck there, Representative Howard.
Chair Dabney, was as amended.
As amended. Thank you very much, Ms. Burt. With that, members, I'll hand the virtual gavel over to Representative Sandstead. Representative Sandstead, gavel is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. For our final bill hearing today, we have House File 4039 from Representative Dabney. Members, it's our intention to lay this bill over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill by 11:55 this morning. Representative Dabney, would you like to make a motion to move House File 4039 before the committee to be laid over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Dabney, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members know of this committee that the school trust lands in Minnesota are special lands, public, but with a specific task of generating revenue for the school children of the state. We, as the legislature, created the Office of School Trust Lands in 2012. In 2020, the legislative auditor performed a special review and came forward with several recommendations. House File 4039 incorporates two of the recommendations of those reports, provides greater clarity on the requirements of the director, more transparency in the director's duties, more uniformity with other executive branch appointees, and provides the office with greater flexibility in managing itself. Madam Chair, with me today is Office of School Trust Lands Director Aaron Vandalin. I'd ask you to call on him to walk through the bill for us. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Vandalin. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Aaron Vandalin, School Trust Lands Director, and Representative Dabney and members of the Permanent School Fund Commission. I am very thankful that they've continued to support this bill. This bill was originally introduced in 2018. Representative Joachim might remember that. And it's been set aside for more pressing matters during the pandemic, but we are back here now to with a new version after the 2020 OLA report. And can walk you through that real quick. So what you see in House File 4039 is Representative Daphne mentioned before, it addresses the OLA recommendations, or at least two of those recommendations, and I will walk through it. So just in section one real quick, at line 1.11, we simply just stricken a date that has already come and gone. I was, as Representative Daphne said, this position was created in 2012. It was not filled until Governor Dayton appointed me in September of 2015. And I was fortunate enough to be reappointed last year by Governor Walz. So that date of December 31st, 2020, I think is obsolete at best. In section two of the bill, mainly at lines 1.17 through 1.8, it removes the requirement for the school trust lands director to take an oath of office. In prior testimony, I was questioned about this and why the director was the only appointee that was required to take an oath of office. So we've modified that and actually now affirmatively stated that the school trust lands director actually does have an affirmative duty to be a fiduciary on behalf of the 860-some thousand kids that are in K through 12 education. Going on further down, what you'll see in the next part of the bill in section two, and this really starts on lines 2.1 down to 2.15. It's we've reorganized, I would say, how this the statute reads. This is my job description, statute 127A353. And what we found is that the rules or the duties that I had were not in just this statute. They were spread across different statutes. And we also wanted to demonstrate what duties we had to, whether it was the executive branch or the legislative branch. So you'll see that split out. The first piece where we're addressing the OLA recommendations is in line 2.16 to 2.19. And there was some concern from the Office of Legislative Auditor that there was whether or not the school trust lands director had to serve as a temporary trustee in condemnation actions or in internal land exchanges in the Department of Natural Resources. So we've changed that here so that there actually is an affirmative duty that the school trust lands director shall serve as a temporary trustee in those situations. Moving down further are really just some simple changes that don't change our duties to the legislative branch or our work with the executive branch. It just clarifies how we work with both branches. And 2.23 to 2.25 is really the main work that we're working on right now with the Department of Natural Resources on our asset management plan. And I'll skip down a little bit further. I think I wanted to point out the other OLA recommendation that we're addressing here, and that's on line 3.16 to 3.19. The legislative auditor made a recommendation that we clarify this language. It, in essence, conflicted with our duties. The director's role is to serve in an advisory or an oversight role for the executive and legislative branches. And the language as it was written actually exceeds those overarching authorities. So we wanted to clarify that. And I should mention that there were four recommendations that the Office of Legislative Auditor made for the School Trust Lands Office. And we addressed two of those with policy and process changes internally. And two of those are the legislative changes that we're seeking. And then finally, the last piece that I wanted to touch on is back on 3.12, and I apologize for jumping around. But 3.13. Right now, my staff, and there are 2.5 of us in the office, including myself. So 1.5 FTEs have to serve an unclassified service. What I've found out is that they can only serve an unclassified service for 5 years, and then I either have to create new positions and rehire them or open it up for new candidates. That really impacts the future continuity of the office if I was not to be reappointed in the future. So what we're seeking here is a change just to allow the director to hire staff and serve in a classified service. With that, Madam Chair, I do not have anything else to discuss about the bill, but I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Vandalin. When this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during a public hearing. We have received no request for public testimony. At this time, if we have...
Members, we seem to have lost Representative Sandsteed. Am I correct, Ms. Burt?
I believe she is trying to log back in here. Just one moment. Here she comes.
Okay.
Well, that was very interesting. My apologies. My internet connection dropped here. Members, I believe before that happened, I had thanked Director Vandalin and made the statement that the there was no request for public testimony. So at this time, we are able to go to questions from members. I am not seeing any hands raised. So Representative Dabney, any closing remarks?
Well, Madam Chair, first, you may recall a few weeks ago, my internet dropped and I actually had to run to the basement to reboot the router, to get it back up and running. So I know what it's like. Members, Director Vandalin, let's not demote you, sir. Thank you for your time today and the work you do with the Office of School Trust Lands. Members, the bill is in many ways technical in nature, but it's an important one for continuing to stand up the Office of School Trust Lands and give it the opportunity to do the work that we've asked it to do, generating the revenue that's then provided to school children across Minnesota on an equal basis. I ask for your support, and I appreciate the time before the committee today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And with that, Representative Dabney renews his motion to lay House File 4039 over for possible inclusion and further consideration at a later date. And with that, members, our meeting is adjourned.